Now, I live my own little pastoral counseling world. I don't live in the big world. And even though I counsel a fair number of people in so-called domestic violence situations, when I started compiling these statistics, it just seemed frightening to me. Frightening in part because you begin to wonder, like, how can this be? You know, can what God intended to be, at least in part, a sanctuary, just how does it become a battlefield in such a grotesque kind of way? Now, the statistics that I threw up on the screen reflect worst-case scenarios: murder, serious injuries, rape. And the truth of the matter is that most of us in counseling probably won't encounter those situations, at least not very often. You won't probably be counseling in a setting or with a person who's that type of dilemma. But what I don't want you to do, and mean saying that, is for you to then to think that, okay, as people like to do with statistics, it's all very sensationalistic. Okay, I don't really think that's the place to go with this. One of the most stable statistics over the last 30 years has been that if you consider the more common forms of violence in the context of marriage, slapping, shoving, grabbing, restraining, then about one-third of women in intimate relationships experience that form of violence more than once with the same partner. More than once. What that means is that most battering is pattern-like. It's not an event. Violence in marriage, when it occurs, rarely occurs as a one-time phenomena. More often than not, it's repeated in the relationship, sometimes throughout the years, over and over and over again. And it's not as if there aren't fluctuations in that, but try to understand that almost all of the time that you're likely to encounter a woman or a marriage where there's been a report of spousal abuse or a report of violence in the marriage, it's highly unlikely that this is the first time that has occurred. Now, in a minute, I'm going to put up a slide that attempts to distinguish between violence and abuse. For now, let me just say this, that violence and abuse almost always exist in a dynamic relationship in these kinds of marriages. Abusive partners aren't always violent, but violent partners are always abusive. That means that when we get to talking about something like physical assault in a marriage, it lives in a context. It lives in the context of the larger picture of what we'll talk about when we define abuse. Why is that important? It's important because the tendency for us when we're counseling in these situations is to be focused in some sense on the safety issues related to physical abuse, getting this abusive person in the relationship to stop, to provide protection and safety, not recognizing that at best what we're doing in that situation is putting a muzzle on a dog that wants to bite. You put a muzzle on a dog, it doesn't change the dog, does it? Because violence comes out and lives out and finds its power in abusive relationships. So if you're going to work successfully as a counselor with the husband or with the wife or with the marriage, you aren't just focused on doing what you can do to prevent physical assault of whatever sort taking place in the marriage. You're addressing the root issue, and what I'm going to propose, amongst other things, is is, in a functional way, the root issue is one, and for that matter, both persons who frequently have no idea, as Christians, and that's who we're talking about counseling, no idea really what God intends marriage to be. The husband doesn't, and frequently the wife doesn't. Now, there is this common truism, and it's true because it's common, and it's common because it happens enough that we think it happens all the time. But you've probably heard, well, people will say that women who are in abusive relationships have already been in a previous abusive relationship. You know what I'm saying? So there's this sense in which, you know, and sometimes I'll hear it from a wife herself. It's like she just thinks she's some kind of violence magnet or abuse magnet. And it happens often enough that when you explore this person's history, you find out that in some sense or another, there has been, whether it's a family of origin or some other relationship, some prelude, some precursor, some relationship that they've already had that has misrepresented for them what intimate relationships are supposed to be like. So one of the most difficult things, this might sound funny, but one of the most difficult things is to convince a woman in an abusive relationship that this isn't the way it's supposed to be. Now, it's a truism because it happens a lot, and it doesn't always happen. You're going to encounter women who find themselves in abusive relationships, and they're the most surprised people of all. But the point I'm trying to make is that violence doesn't happen. It comes from someplace, and where it comes from is this utter violation of what God has to say when he talks about marriage. Now, there is one other observation to make, besides the fact that obviously that most victims are women and most abusers are men. The other observation to make, both anecdotally and statistically, is domestic violence always is on an escalating pattern. It always gets worse. Until people are transformed, it never stays neutral, it always gets worse. Now, what that means is, whatever my gut instinct might be about a particular marriage or a particular husband, I can never say to a woman, well, you won't be a statistic. Your husband is a non-escalating sinner. I dare not say that. What I dare do is look at each woman that I counsel, who I counsel because she's in an abusive relationship, as a statistic in the making. I have no way of ever being able to say to that particular person, well, yeah, but your husband has limits. Your boyfriend has limits. It can't happen to you. There's no reason to presume that. Why? Because the heart of violence is rooted in the heart of abuse. Now, indulge me for at least 1 minute here. I'm showing you this slide. This workshop's about violence in marriage, and so I'm giving you this list of the things that we define as violence in marriage, and you're going to look at that and you go, well, duh, of course. But what might be self-evident to you, ironically, is not self-evident to the men and women that I counsel, the people in the pew. There's been many times that I've had to convince a husband that when he walks up to his wife in anger and he grabs her on the biceps and squeezes really hard, even though he's fine, it's not that that's just sinful, it's violent. He's okay. But his perception is what we used to say when I used to play basketball, no blood, no foul. Now, it isn't just the physicality. It isn't just the physical part of it. It's the mindset that doesn't see that for what it is, that is at the root of the escalation that takes place in abusive situations. Those two things together are what you're trying to unpack in the life of the husband, if that's who you get to counsel. Well, but I haven't cheated on her yet, or I haven't cheated on her. I can't tell you the number of times I'll hear that from a husband who maybe is on the verge of having his wife file a PFA, protection from abuse order, or the elders have asked him to leave his home, and he's in this desperate place. And what is he saying when he says that? Well, but I haven't cheated on her. I mean, I suppose the implication is cheating is bad, but beating is okay. But what he's really getting at is, at least in his thinking, well, if I had committed adultery, I can understand why you guys would be doing this to me. But when it comes to abuse or violence, you forgive and you move on. And so there's this notion that while it's a serious matter, it's not that serious. It certainly isn't as serious as something like adultery. Because if it were that, then I would understand why you're asking me to leave, or I understand why the church is involved, or I understand why the elders are prepared to discipline me. I don't understand that in this context because I feel bad about it. So let's just forget it. Let's move on. Now here's the second slide. I want to discuss this term for a second, abuse. This word has suffered from much misuse and overuse. It's certainly part of the popular self-help culture. And rightly so, we're wary of it because, as you know, people have justified an awful lot of things on the basis of having been abused, most often as a child. And so, you know, any word that sort of has that much baggage attached to it, you know, I think in some ways we need to be wary of. But I'm going to use the word, at least today, in a manner consistent with its actual dictionary definition. To abuse simply means to use wrongly or improperly. It means to use wrongly or improperly. Now, that definition might seem benign to you because normally when we think about abuse, we use it as a quantity word. Okay? There's this thing, but if it's really bad, it's abuse. So the child who gets spanked, that's discipline. You leave a mark, it's abuse. Abuse is bad because it sort of represents some end of the continuum. And it's not that I'm opposed to trying to find words to capture the extreme ends of continuum, but there's going to be a problem that develops from that, and I'll point that out to you in a second. But let me just try to talk to you about how I want to use this word and how I want you to think about it. If we start talking about the idea of using or misusing something, and we talk about marriage, and we talk about marriage as a covenant relationship that two people enter into before God, then a covenant represents certain promises that people make that reflect their intentions in that relationship. Misuse is a violation of trust of that covenant relationship. Now, let me just, this is probably be a dumb illustration, but let me see if this works for you. Now, my dad was a tool maker, tool and die maker, and you know, I grew up hearing stories about Bridgeport milling machines and making parts through thousands of an inch tolerance and stuff. We just grew up around tools. And my brother and I were like fix-it guys. When I was 11, I decided to help my dad out by cleaning the lawnmower. So I took the lawnmower apart and cleaned every piece. But didn't realize I had no idea how to put the lawnmower back together. But every piece to that lawnmower, every screw in that lawnmower was really clean. So we just, you know, Dad was okay. I mean, we used his tools. We took things out of the toolbox. And, you know, I don't know. I guess, just remember, I still have to grade your paper. You know, your typical 11-year-old, I'd use a tool and I'd kind of get involved with something else and I'd leave the tools on the floor of the basement or the garage or something. And Dad would come home and he'd see his precious hand tools on the floor. And the first thing that would happen is he would find us and he would march us to wherever those tools were and we would get those tools. And before dinner or before play or any other chore, those tools would be supervised back into the toolbox, along with lectures all along the way. Now, one summer, I was using my dad's socket wrench, and I was doing something in the backyard. I think I'm in denial. It was a repressed memory as to what it was. In any case, I was using my dad's socket wrench like a hammer, mostly because I was too lazy to get the hammer. And then I got thinking about something else, and I left this socket wrench in the grass in the backyard. Okay, a couple days passed, there's dew, you know what happens to tools when there's dew, it's all rusty. My father found his socket wrench with the lawnmower, if you understand what I'm saying. Now, that was the only time that I ever got a spanking for a tool situation. I didn't get a spanking because I took the lawnmower apart. Why did I get a spanking? Because I had violated the toolmaker's code. You don't abuse tools. You can forget where they are, you can borrow them and forget to give them back, but you don't abuse them. I wasn't allowed to use tools for a year, and that was after I replaced the socket wrench that had been eaten by the lawnmower. Now, what had I done that was so bad? I had violated a trust from my father's point of view. This was his life. They weren't just a peripheral thing. You know, I probably trashed a lot of things, but I didn't. You don't trash your dad's tools, at least when he's a toolmaker. I had violated his trust. He had willingly entrusted to me those things that were special, and I had broken trust with him. Anybody here a pastor? Okay. When you do a wedding ceremony, I do a wedding ceremony, there's this thing called presentation of the bride. Remember that? And his dad escorts his daughter down, you know, beautiful situation. He's standing there, he's all nervous and stuff. And at some point I look at him and I say, who gives this woman to be married to this man? And he'll say, her mother and I, or I do. Well, what is that? That's a symbolic gesture where here is this dad who is taking this precious possession of his, so to speak, and he is entrusting her to this new person. And if that dad, as a Christian father, has fulfilled the covenant God has asked him to raise up his daughter in the fear and admonition of the Lord, he's presuming that this young man will fulfill a similar covenant, a similar responsibility. Now, what is it that this man will love his daughter in a particular way? This is a passage that we know well. Not that he will love her a lot. Paul says that husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church. Well, meaning what? Not that he was passionate about her, but that he would be passionate about what God is passionate about. That she would be made holy and blameless. Now, of course, this is this important text where Paul is talking not just about the relationship of a husband and a wife, but he's talking about the marriage relationship, the metaphor that defines my relationship with Jesus Christ, that defines the church's relationship with Jesus Christ. You know, we sometimes act as if that the only thing that matters in marriage, the only covenant that's relevant in marriage, is the covenant of fidelity. Now, how do we get there? Well, we get there because in some ways, when we talk about what are the most outrageous things that can happen in a marriage, and I mean, of course, one of the first things that comes up is adultery, and we think about Matthew 19, and here is this particular thing, this particular way in which a covenant is broken that's so egregious that God would consider the covenant to be capable of being nullified. So it's right high up on our list, isn't it? But let me ask you a question. How many of you are married? Just raise your hands. When you got married, did you expect more from your spouse than that he might be or she might be faithful? Was that the only covenant you were expecting that person to keep? Is that the only promise? Now, you know, the interesting thing was, I was talking to someone earlier about this, and we got talking about marriage vows, and here's the interesting thing. We tend to think that marriage is a bit like a contract, and I can only be held accountable for what I had to say on that particular afternoon, you know? And when I marry people, sometimes they'll write their own vows, and sometimes we'll use traditional vows, and the implication is, you know, you can only hold me accountable for what I said that day. And I didn't say I wouldn't beat you. Is that really how God intends for us to think about marriage? That the only thing that I'm supposed to be held accountable for is the specific covenant of fidelity? Well, if it's the case that the mystery of Christ and the church and the mystery of marriage in some sense are one and the same, then if I'm to understand marriage, I'm to understand that everything that is true about Christ in his relationship to the church, who is the bride, is true in some sense about a relationship between a husband and a wife. Regardless of what I say or I don't say, when I get married, God intends to teach me what he means by covenant faithfulness, not what I mean. What he intended to be included in the concept of a covenant. Now, what I'm about to say may seem controversial to you. We can talk about it later, or maybe not. But I'd suggest to you that the things that I put up on the screen in the form of physical violence, and for that matter, those things that fall within the category of abuse, and remember, I'm sort of going to use those terms distinctively, that I'm going to suggest to you those things are such an outrageous breach of what God intended for marriage that they form a kind of covenant breaking. God certainly didn't intend for a wife to experience those things at the hand of the person that he entrusted her to. Now, we forget sometimes that even though, in some respects, that dad who says, okay, she's yours now, that God himself never gives up his parental rights, does he? Now, what's the point? The point is that a lot of times counselors, pastors, even the victims and the husbands talk about violence and abuse in purely quantitative ways. How bad is it, or how much can I take? You know, and it occurred to me, I was saying to somebody else, like, I must be the anti-workshop here, because if you think about the theme, we're talking about suffering in the relationship of a believer in the world, and so much of the emphasis has been on persevering in the face of trials, right? And seeing Christ in the midst of that. I'm the one person maybe who's saying, no. God didn't intend for you to persevere in this. This is an outrageous violation of his purpose and his plan for marriage. This was not part of the design. And my goal isn't primarily to teach a woman how to take a punch. My goal is to teach her to think about marriage the way God intended and to act accordingly. We sometimes get the idea that abuse is sinful not so much by what it is, but instead by what it's like. So if it's not that bad, it's not that sinful. Because so often I'll talk to women in that situation and they'll say to me, well, I have learned to cope with it. As if somehow that changes its fundamental character. It is just not the case that sticks and stones will break my bones, but names will never hurt me. That is not God's plan for marriage. Now, I keep saying that, and I'm saying that for this reason. Not that you can read my mind, but one of the frustrating and perplexing things about counseling people in this situation is that you seem somehow more worried about their safety and their security than they do. And my experience has been the reason that that's the case is because before we can even ultimately talk about safety issues, I have to, if you're that woman, convince you that this is not what God had in mind for you. And the more that people are caught up in the web of abuse and violence, and the more that it is a part of their history, particularly if it is rooted in their family of origin, the more difficult it is for them by faith to believe that this just isn't the way it's supposed to be. This isn't just the way marriages are supposed to be like, particularly if those are the marriages that they've observed growing up and known. This is just how it is. And what I need God to do is basically teach me how to take a punch. Teach me how to persevere, how to endure, how to be okay, how to dissociate, how to deny, and how to repress what's taking place in my life. And I want to liberate that person from those misconceptions. Now, the statistics that I threw up on the screen were statistics that have to do with the nation at large. And, you know, I hunted around and tried to come up with some statistics for the church, but couldn't come up with any. And partly the reason is because there's any number of really good reasons, we think, for us as believers to see no evil, hear no evil, speak no evil. This is not a thing that we really want to address too much within the body of Christ. Now, there are a number of reasons for that. First of all, there's a kind of secrecy attached to this, and this is secrecy attached to it for non-believers too, but there's a particular, peculiar kind of secrecy to this issue within the context of the church. Have you ever heard something like, I never would have thought of so-and-so as... Do you ever hear something like that? You know, we look at the folks that are in our congregations, the people that we minister to, and so often, when something like this comes to light, we go, no, not that family, not that guy, not that woman. And there's this pervading sense that this is not something that you bring into the light. It's somehow not Christian. Or Christian families aren't supposed to have these problems, so we don't really talk about them. But there are a couple of other reasons, a couple of the what I call twists to this. And the first is that, well, if it's happening to you, you probably brought it on. Now, please understand what I'm saying here. Yes, every once in a while I'll hear someone in the congregation in some sense say something nonsensical like that. But the people who say this most to me are the victims. They've been trained to think that if this is happening in my life, you know, it's just like in Job 4, consider now, who being innocent has ever perished? Where the upright, if this is happening to me, it must be because it's my fault. I somehow brought this into my own life. You hear that most often from the victim. And then how do we hear it from the abuser? Well, if you didn't provoke me, this wouldn't happen. So whose fault is it? Well, it's kind of my fault, but if you hadn't provoked me. So it's kind of really your fault. Now, there are some other things to consider too. This whole conference is about learning to see Jesus Christ magnified and glorified and empower you in the midst of suffering that is often unjust and unwanted. And I've just thrown James up here. It's been referenced any number of times. There are a lot of places that we could talk about. But what we're getting at here is that, well, God is in the business of strengthening me in the midst of trials. Why not this as well? 1 Peter chapter 2, verses 12 through chapter 3, verse 2. A lot of times is a passage I've read and I've seen pastors and other people quote and saying, well, look, you know, Peter is saying to a slave, you know, if you get beaten for an unjust reason and you endure it, that's commendable to God. In the same way, wives, if you get beaten by your husbands for an unjust reason, well, that's commendable to God. I've seen people exegete the text that way. It has nothing to do with Peter saying. Peter is calling believers who are caught in circumstances that they have no control over. And what would be more of an example of that than a slave who has no control over his circumstance at all, that in those situations, to have an attitude the same as that as of Christ Jesus. In the same way, wives, be submitted to your husbands. In the same way, husbands, love your wives and treat them as the weaker vessel. In the same way, in the same way. But a lot of times we'll use this text and other texts to support the idea that the most glorious thing a wife can do is to be abused by her husband for the sake of Jesus Christ. The problem with that kind of thinking is that it, in some sense, nullifies everything else God says about the purpose and intents of marriage. Now, do people get sinned against in marriage? Of course they do. Are they sinned against in heinous ways? Of course they are. Is it God's intent for a pattern of this kind of sin to characterize a marriage between a Christian man and a Christian woman? No, it's not. Okay, we're all okay with that. But would God then say to this woman, well, persevere in this particular form of sin because it brings glory to me? I don't think so. I don't believe that would be what he would say. Come on, don't be ornery. Thank you. All right, anybody remember when we actually started? All right, let me give you a way of coming at these things. a procedure of sorts. Three things to think about: assess, protect and provide, equip and empower. Now, after you've counseled for a while, you know, I'm sort of throwing this model up here, and I just want you to realize that I'm just trying to give you some systematic ways of thinking about this process. I was involved in a situation where a woman came running into the church with several of her kids, but not all of them, coming from away from an abusive incident with her husband, who also happened to be psychotic. And I wasn't interested in assessing the situation. All I was interested in doing is finding a way to get her other child, who was still at school, from going home to where her dad was. That was my only interest. And as it turned out, we were able to do that. And then the dad, wondering where all things were going, showed up at church, and security called me and said, "The dad's here. Oh, by the way, he has a gun." So, you know, this is a model, but this isn't, you know, there's nothing carved in stone here. This is just a way for you to think systematically about some of the processes. Now, when we're talking about spousal abuse, we're talking really about a whole range of contexts that you're going to have to think through. And I've just thrown a few of those things up here. Sometimes you're going to counsel in the context where you're just counseling a couple, they come in for marital counseling, and somehow the violence or the abuse comes to light in the midst of the counseling. They're already involved in counseling, already seeing them. Something to appreciate is that anytime there's violence in a marriage, that marriage is globally impaired. Now, sometimes couples will come for counseling and they'll want you to tweak some part of their relationship. You know, pretty much everything's going okay, but there's this one thing they're sort of struggling with. If you encounter domestic violence in a marriage, you should presume that this marriage is totally messed up. There's practically nothing that works in this marriage. Why? Because if the root of violence in a marriage is abuse, and abuse is such a thorough, captivating violation of what God has for marriage, there's no way that that marriage can have very much that's healthy about it. Now, the reason I'm mentioning that to you is that all of a sudden you begin to discover that there's just so many horribly wrong things about this marriage, and you have this giant counseling agenda that you want to work on. I'm going to shrink that down for you. You only have one agenda with that counselee and her husband, and that agenda is to create a safe place and to bring an end to the abuse. That is your only agenda for that moment. Everything else may be wrong in that marriage. The only thing that you have to worry about in that moment is to bring an end to the violence and the abuse. That is your one goal at that point. Ever try to counsel a drunk? Pretty hard, isn't it? And so, if you talk to people who work with substance abusers, one of the first things they'll tell you is, you know, whatever problem a person has, until their addiction in some sense is under control, until you detox them and until they're sober, don't be thinking you're going to talk to them about anything else. Violence in the marriage is just like that. Whatever other issues might be prevailing in the marriage, they are not relevant until the safety issues are addressed, taken care of. Now, other times, of course, counseling spousal abuse is a crisis situation. Sometimes the victim herself will come to you. Sometimes you'll get a report by someone who's close to the victim. Occasionally, things will happen through law enforcement. In all of those situations, the same goal prevails. The goal is, I know that there's all kinds of things that are wrong about your relationship, and we'll talk about that at some point. Right now, we have one concern. Now, do you think that that woman is going to get on board with that agenda? Well, some, but some not. Why? Because in spite of the fact that she's coming to you looking for safety, this is her world. This is what she knows. And she's always somewhat ambivalent about the changes that you need to take place, and she's certainly not going to get support from her abusive husband to bring those things to an end. He's going to be mortified that the secret is out. And he's looking to find some way to do damage control. And the last situation is when husbands come for counseling for anger management. Now, I'm just putting that up because I certainly see a lot of men in our church who have anger issues and come for anger management counseling. But let me just tell you that even though abusive husbands can be angry, they don't need anger management. You understand? The issues that generate abuse and violence in the context of the marriage will not be ameliorated by going through a 10-week anger management program, Christian or otherwise. But a lot of times what precipitates the abuse coming to light is that, you know, this person has had just one too many acting out episodes and his wife has issued an ultimatum or someone else has heard about it. And so here's this person and he's sort of coming looking for help. And what's your problem? Well, I have a little problem with anger. Oh, okay. Well, a lot of times my wife provokes me and sometimes I hit her. If you know anything about working with people who have anger issues, one of the things that you find pretty quickly is the things that you would do with an angry person have very little to do with the things that you would do with an abusive husband in the way of counseling them. Okay. But that's the context that you're going to encounter. Now, let me emphasize to you this point that I think it's incredibly important that you understand that there are all these other issues dangling out there, just all very tempting. There may be things you know more about in the context of marriage counseling. Please don't go after those things. Because if you don't go seriously after the issue of abuse in the marriage, you become, in effect, an enabler. You're sort of saying, yeah, I know this is right there and it's right here, but you're okay, aren't you? You can take another one, can't you? And you, in effect, reinforce the value system that this woman probably is already coming to counseling with. You need to become an advocate for the oppressed in the same way that God is an advocate for the oppressed. Now, after you understand the context, your first goal is to assess the safety issues. What is the present level of safety in this relationship? And I want to tell you that what is subjective is the most important thing, particularly in a crisis intervention. Now, what do I mean by that? I'm thinking about situations where a woman comes to me as her pastor and begins to describe a situation where abuse has taken place. And I quickly get a call, a damage control from the husband who wants to tell me his side of the story. And he wants me to know that it didn't happen the way that she's claiming, and you know, and there's this whole sort of thing that unfolds. And particularly really what he wants me to do is proclaim to his wife that things are okay and you can go home now. Now, when I talk about the subjectivity aspect of it, let us just say, for the sake of the argument, that I believe the husband. Let's just say that I do. It's not relevant. It's not relevant. What's relevant is how she feels. Now, remember my example, I jumped down and I grabbed this brother. I mean, if we had more time, I'd perform a little experiment. I'm a little bit leery to do that, but I would find some willing female victim And I would grab her in the way that some husband might grab her. And I would know I didn't mean nothing by it. Do you think she would still feel afraid? But I didn't mean anything by it. Is that relevant? Is my intention relevant? No, all that is relevant is her experience. And so when you're looking at issues of safety, whatever I might think, however I might review the incident and hear all the stories, what matters most to me is how she feels in the situation. Now, I will, along the way, try to do my best to review with her all of the things that have taken place. Why? Because remember, I'm saying to you that violence and abuse live dynamically together, and there is a pattern of escalation that typifies that dynamic relationship. And as I'm hearing the story, and I hear more of the story, I'm getting a better and better idea of really how safe this woman is. How does her husband typically respond after the abuse is over? In fact, one of the things that I'll sometimes, if I have the luxury to, I'll ask this counselee to write for me, help me construct what I call a violence and abuse timeline. Let's talk about the history of the abuse that's taken place in the context of your marriage. Now, all of those things are specifically designed for me to have my own sense of to what extent I think this woman can objectively evaluate her own situation. And on many occasions, I will do everything in my power to insist on a course of action that is contrary to her knee-jerk reaction to, now I feel safe, I guess I'll go home. I'm sorry, that's shorthand for counselee. Okay. Now, incidentally, just as we're talking about this assessment process, you know, when you start getting this abuse timeline information, you know, there's just all these wonderful rabbit trails you just want to go down and explore. Please don't do that. Because when you're in this situation, you have one goal. Your goal is to, as quickly as you can, as thoroughly as you can, evaluate the extent to which this woman is likely to become a statistic. I'm interested in looking for patterns of escalation. And incidentally, I'm saying you have to first define for the counselee the meaning of terms. An awful lot of things, remember I showed you my little slide of what constitutes violence? Well, he just threw me down on the bed. He didn't really hurt me. He just grabbed me, but he didn't punch me. Yes, ma'am. Yes. Although, depending on the situation, I'll do anything that I think is appropriate if I think that there's a risk issue.
What was the question?
The question was, if the couple is coming together for counseling, would you ask questions about an abuse or violence timeline? The answer is no. This is the information that you're going to get from this man's wife. But I have been in situations where it has become obvious to me, and maybe I'm the only of the three of us, that it was obvious that this was an abusive relationship. And I had to say, well, you know, let me give you some definitions of what I think represents sinful violence in a marriage. And I sort of started naming things. And I could immediately see, as it were, the light going on over this woman's head and the scowl coming on her husband's face. They were in inverse relationship. Because I had just brought to light what was hidden in darkness in that relationship.
Well,
That is true. But the interesting thing is that in view of what represents the secrecy, the comment was, isn't it the case that in some situations a woman can put herself at risk, in danger, if she brings up the issue of abuse in the context of couples counseling? The answer is yes. But here's the other side of it. Why do you think she brought it up? She's been keeping this thing secret for a really long time. The reason that she brought it up in that context was that she was hoping that I would respond the right way. She was hoping that I would be concerned for her safety. Okay. That's just my example of the abuse timeline. If you guys don't mind, I'm going to start moving a little bit faster. Because you know, actually last year a lot of people asked for my notes on my anger and sexual addiction stuff, and so this time I thought I was really clever and I put my email address on the very first slide. But yes, if you'd like, if you want to just email me personally, I'll be happy to send you back a copy of that. Assess the situation. What is this person's support system like? What are their circumstances, their housing, their finances like? What are the potential dangers? And this is the answer to that question. Anytime that you talk to a woman about her response to the abuse, she has to weigh what are the consequences of living in the abuse versus the consequences of getting out of that. For her. And some of those consequences are danger consequences. Other consequences are logistical. Where shall I go? How am I going to live? Who's going to take care of the kids? So more often than not, it's nice for me to say, look, you know, you just need to get out of this situation. And she'll say, well, that's really great. And am I going to stay at your house tonight? So you need to assess those things and explore those options with her, and not just that, the issue of self-harm as well. All right, the second item on our list is to protect and provide. When I'm counseling this woman, the first thing I'm interested in are what I consider her current strategies. Now, if she's been in this relationship for a long time, she has developed her own way of trying to survive. How does she massage her husband's conflicted and wounded ego? How does she protect her children? What are her coping strategies? How does she learn to endure? What are the ways that she deals with those things right now? Because inevitably, most of those things, and at least in their own way, are going to be partly successfully and successful and partly dysfunctional. So if I'm going to help her, the first thing I have to be able to understand is, what have you been doing up to this point in this relationship? Tell me how you make it. What are the things that you do? What are your strategies? What then, secondly, is the likelihood that your husband will change given the strategies that you are utilizing? Do they work? Has he any different? And abusive husbands are famous for having lots of remorse and no repentance. You know, there are very, very few men that I've ever encountered in counseling, if they have been abusive to their wives or physically violent, don't feel really bad about it. They do. They feel terrible. They cry, they promise, they profess their love, they suggest acts of penance that they're willing to do, acts of contrition. But God says that there's a kind of remorse that leads to death, and there's a kind of remorse that leads to repentance. And I want that wife to understand the difference. Who or what does she blame the behavior on? How much of her assessment of that situation is directed at herself, directed at her children, directed at the situation? And I'll ask her to suggest to me why she thinks these things happen from the vantage point of her husband. What do you think goes on in your husband's heart when all this occurs? All of these things are giving me some idea of the way that I need to encourage this woman to take steps, hopefully in the context of the ministry of the church, to provide protection and bring an end to what has nothing to do with God intended for marriage. Let's discuss the alternatives. And this goes back to what I call harm risk assessment. There will be her opinion and mine. And those two things aren't always going to be consistent with one another. What are the things that you can do to bring an end to this? What is she willing to do? An awful lot of women who are caught in these relationships can tell you that what's taking place is really horrible, but in their mind there's nothing they can do, so there's nothing they're willing to do to end the situation. What are the risks of each strategy, and what are the resources that are required for her to enact a particular strategy? And then there's the creation of what we call a safety plan. Now, safety plans are for women who, as you're counseling them, have not made decisions as to what they're going to do, but are telling you that the likelihood that their husband will victimize them again is extremely high. And so you encourage them to find a way that in the event that this occurs, these are the things that you already know that you can already do if you need to get out. And I'll discuss that really specifically. How do you get out? Where do you go? More than one time, people will come, hat in hand, children, a few possessions, and show up at the church, hoping that we'll be able to provide them with some place to stay, some form of sanctuary. Now, this, I suppose, is more to me an admonition. I pastor in a very large church, maybe 8,000 or 9,000 adults. And so on the one side, we have lots of people problems, but we also have lots of resources. And the worst thing that happens in situations like this is that it's rarely the case that a woman who's being caught up in an abusive relationship has the wherewithal to do anything about it. And this is to me where, you know, if you're in a counseling ministry, you need to consider how your church is going to minister to folks in these situations. How is the church going to respond? Or are we going to be, well, you know, this is really a difficult situation. I have an hour next week available for you. Or am I going to be able to find a way to minister to this woman in the way that she really needs it right now? This last thing we'll talk about briefly is what I call equip and empower. Equip means that you furnish someone with the qualities necessary for performance. You know, the scripture says that I'm a pastor, that I equip the saints for the work of service. I give them the tools that they need to go out and do what God has called them to do. And when I empower them, I give them the opportunity then to do it. I give them the necessary tools to go out and do what God has instructed them to do. I'm going to assess the situation. I'm going to take steps to provide and protect for this woman. But more importantly, when we start getting to what's really going on inside of her, I need to both equip, I need to get her to begin to see what God wants her to see about who she is, about what marriage is, about what's going on inside of the life and heart of her husband. She needs to be instructed in the truth. I need to model for her and have other people model for her relationship skills that have been neglected or never acquired because she has lived most of her life in this abusive relationship. And I need to teach her the correct responses to the abuse that's presently taking place. That is how I'm equipping her. I'm empowering her when I encourage and increase her faith to do what God would have her to do in a situation that can only be done by faith. Now, if you've ever spent time talking to a person caught up in a situation like this, you understand that this is a frustrating person to talk to because you sometimes think you care more about her than she does. You see things more clearly than she does, and she's the one who's going through all of this. You know, why am I working harder to convince you that this is really terrible? Like, this is your deal. You should understand this. Well, why is that? Well, when you spend time in this situation, you begin to see how, over the course of time, this person's heart and their mind have become blinded, and you are bringing truth into her life, sometimes for the very first time, about what God means for marriage to be, what His plan was. I remember one session with a woman whose husband beat her pretty frequently. And just couldn't seem to get her to move on anything we were talking about. And we just began to talk about what marriage was supposed to be. Not about her abuse, not about what her husband was doing, just about God's vision for marriage. And after about 30 minutes of that, this woman began to weep. To sob, really. And she said, I didn't realize that God loved me that much. And we were talking about marriage. And after she was able to realize that, then she was able to begin to take steps to bring an end to the abuse in her relationship. Do you understand? You have to equip a person to see what is true. And then in your relationship with them as a counselor, empower them to, by faith, act on what the truth is in regards to their situation, in regards to marriage. These are the things that go on in her heart. She is hopeless. She is helpless from her vantage point. She usually experiences post-traumatic stress. She's depressed. She's angry, although she's afraid to express her anger at her husband. She's full of fear. She's vulnerable. She has no idea, most of the time, what God means when He talks about intimacy and sexuality and the roles and responsibilities in marriage. These are her goals in this marriage: to survive, to have peace at any cost, to protect her children, and occasionally, someday, to get revenge. And the coping mechanisms that she has that service those goals, she is a peace broker, she is a blame magnet, it's my fault, she's an ego builder, a pacifier, and a rescuer. These are all the aspects reflect her worldview that as you equip her, you are attempting to dismantle those things piece by piece and give her a biblical alternative. Last thing. One of the things you want to do is begin to understand how she makes sense out of her world. She has certain filters. These are her memories, her thoughts about the abuse that's taken place in her past, and the private logic that she exercises that makes sense only to her, doesn't make sense to you. It's not common sense. It's not common logic. It's private logic in which she finds a way to survive in that setting. And just one example. If I could just be perfect, he wouldn't hit me. If I could just be perfect, he wouldn't hit me. That's a common scheme, a common filter in the life of an abused woman. Well, in so many situations, we are called as believers to endure and persevere and to see Christ glorified in that. This is not the place. This is not the context. And while, in fact, If you're married, you realize you are married to a sinner, and that person will sin against you, and God requires of you as his child to repent of your own hard-heartedness, to forgive, to show mercy and grace. There's a kind of pattern of sin in the context of marriage which is such a violation of God's design for marriage that I would propose to you that it represents a fundamental break of the covenant of marriage. And your goal in counseling is not to teach that woman how to survive it better, how to endure it better, but to empower her to see what God says marriage is, that that was not his intent for her life, and to give her the strength to take steps to bring what is such an outrageous violation to an end. Now let's pray. Lord, I think of that one statistic that says that a woman is battered in her home every 15 seconds. How can that be? We look to you, the God of mercy, that you would extend mercy to every woman in that setting, that you would also extend mercy and forgiveness to the men who sin against their wives in this way, but that, Lord, that you would bring these things to an end. And that for those of us who counsel, that you'd give us the wisdom and the faith to play our role, the role that you've called us in, to bring truth in the middle of this dark place. And to be your servants, to provide and protect for those who seem unable to do that for themselves. Lord, make us wise in this, we ask in your Son's great name. Amen.